Good afternoon. This is Dynamic Health on CFRO 102.7 FM. And our usual host, Prof. Woodruff, can't be with us today. I'm John Pranger, and I apologize for last week's mistake in identifying the program as Investing in Health. It is, in fact, or was, in fact, Dynamic Health. Well, last week I described how methods for acquiring medical knowledge started in the West, soundly enough, in the 4th century B.C., with the Greek scholar Hippocrates, who fathered the concept of clinical research, that is to say, human-based research. Then in 2nd century Rome, Galen put Hippocrates' human-based medical research substantially off course. He might have continued investigation of the human model, but this practice was stanched by the moral opposition of the already state-supported Christian church, forbidding human autopsy. So Galen cut up goats and pigs and monkeys, and for this there was no injunction, and forged broad theories of disease and physiology, most of them falling far short of accuracy, and his errors bound up with the church's prohibitions and virtual canonization of Galen himself, suffocated medicine for 1,500 years. Not until the Renaissance was the authority of the church broken by the work of Vesalius, who, through autopsy of hanged criminals, corrected Galen's glaring errors and set medical discovery on the right way once more. And animal experimentation would have died as a foundation of medicine, a slow but certain death, had it not been revived in the mid-19th century by a French physiologist, Claude Bernard, a failed medical student who took to lab experimentation like flies to a corpse, and once more science was stood on its head. And swept along by the interplay between arrogance and ignorance, fear and greed, like most senseless conventions, the protocol requiring animal testing all but established itself. It moved of its own momentum for a while, was eventually systematized, and then finally it was mandated by the Congress of the United States. The scientific atmosphere of the early 20th century was already infatuated with the benefits of animal experimentation, as we've explained. And by that we mean the control, the immediacy, the prestige, the money, thanks to Claude Bernard and others. And then a single episode in 1937 effectively routinized animal testing for medications in the United States. In 1937, people received Elixir of Sulfanamide, or that is, sulfanilamide, rather, a new sulfur drug antibiotic dissolved in diethylene glycol, a chemical similar to antifreeze. 107 people died, most of them children. Scientists administered the medicine to animals, and they too died. Well, this single occasion of parity convinced the scientific community that animals should henceforward be used for testing all medications, that diethylene glycol just happened coincidentally to be fatal to humans and to some other creatures could not possibly prove that all chemicals react the same in all species, but that erroneous conclusion prevailed nevertheless. Even in the 30s, however, there was some scientific dissension. In a publication of that epoch, a physician stated that the results of drug experiments upon animals are, as far as their application to man is concerned, absolutely useless and even misleading. And that appeared in the December 1, 1933 issue of Medical World, a leading medical journal. In 1938, Congress passed the Food, Drug, and Cosmetics Act, demanding that drug manufacturers provide proof that their medications were safe. Congress bestowed responsibility for overseeing the act to the Food and Drug Administration, a division of the Department of Health and Human Services. Then World War II broke out. New drugs proliferated as the government hastened medication through the manufacturing process and out into the war zones. The urgency for antibiotics and vaccines gripped the engine of pharmaceutical development and spun it furiously. It became a perpetual motion machine. Pharmaceutical companies grasped at any and every substance, natural or synthetic, which even hinted of a marketable therapeutic effect, then tried it out on animals. When lamb animals did not manifest ill side effects or die, the drug companies jammed the substances through human trials, most of which were far too abbreviated to provide substantial data in regard to possible side effects. In an effort to maximize their profits from these often jury-rigged medications, pharmaceutical companies patented them. With a patented monopoly of 17 years, they could continue selling the therapies at a high price. Up until this time, people had been largely self-medicating, purchasing medicines from the corner pharmacy, either on their own or at the family doctor's suggestion. The advent of these new alleged cures meant that the friendly neighborhood pharmacist was no longer mixing up a few milligrams of assorted compounds in his mortar. Pharmaceutical companies created their own cures and then scurried to establish confidence in their products from physicians. Through heavy marketing, through complimentary leather bags and Merck manuals, free trips, and ample samples, drug companies made sure the medical world heard of and used their products. In 1951, legislation introduced by then-Senator Hubert Humphrey, who had been a pharmacist, mandated that most drugs would require prescriptions. This event strengthened the symbiosis between physicians and drug companies. Patients were more reliant than ever on their physicians. Physicians could make more money. And by helping physicians earn more money, pharmaceutical companies got richer. Theirs became a money-making symbiosis of which the patient was both beneficiary and victim. As the 50s wore on, alarming side effects from these supposed miracle cures began to emerge. Probably the most notorious of all tragic side effect stories is that of thalidomide, a drug intended to ameliorate morning sickness that was also, as an antispasmodic, as an antihistamine, and as a sedative, a component in cough syrup and analgesics of the time. A German pediatrician named Wiedekund Lenz was the first to suggest a link between thalidomide and teratogenesis. Teratogenesis comes from the Greek word teras, meaning malformation or monstrosity. Teratogenesis is the chemical introduction of malformation in a developing fetus. And in the case of thalidomide, the birth defect was phocomelia. Chemicals that produce birth defects are called teratogenic. Mothers who had taken thalidomide gave birth to babies with often shocking deformities. Most lacked developed limbs. The first recorded case of phocomelia secondary to thalidomide occurred on Christmas Day, 1956, but in 1957, the drug was released anyway. A clinician from Australia, W.G. McBride, confirmed thalidomide's danger. Alarmed, he and Lenz wrote, and others wrote letters to the distinguished medical publication The Lancet, reporting phocomelia in infants of mothers taking thalidomide. As the incidence of deformity increased, scientists frantically attempted to reproduce teratogenesis from thalidomide in animals of all varieties. They gave thalidomide to scores of animals, looking for proof in animals of what they already knew occurred in humans, that thalidomide could cross the placenta and drastically damage unborn offspring. But they couldn't find any animal to produce those results. Since animal testing had not indicated a problem with thalidomide, its use persisted. Hence, animal testing delayed the recall of this highly teratogenic drug. Finally, one breed of rabbit, the white New Zealand rabbit, was affected, and then only at a dose between 25 to 300 times that given to humans. Eventually, some monkeys gave birth to hideously deformed offspring, too, but it took 10 times the normal dose to make this happen. Two scientists summarized the thalidomide testing as follows. An unexpected finding was that the mouse and rat were resistant, the rabbit and hamster variably responsive, and certain strains of primates were sensitive to thalidomide developmental toxicity. Different strains of the same species of animals were also found to have highly variable sensitivity to thalidomide. So animal tests provided no real predictive value for any animal except the one being tested. Writing on chemically induced birth defects, James Chardine remarked, in approximately 10 strains of rats, 15 strains of mice, 11 breeds of rabbit, 2 breeds of dogs, 3 strains of hamsters, 8 species of primates, and in other such varied species as cats, armadillos, guinea pigs, swine, and ferrets, in which thalidomide has been tested, teratogenic effects have been induced only occasionally. Chardin went on to write, "It is the actual results of teratogenicity testing in primates which have been most disappointing in consideration of these animals' possible use as a predictive model. While some 9 subhuman primates, all but the bush baby, have demonstrated the characteristic limb defects observed in humans when administered thalidomide, the results with 83 other agents with which primates have been tested are less than perfect. Of the 15 listed supposed or reputed human teratogens tested in non-human primates, only 8 were also teratogenic in one or more of the various species. The data with respect to suspect or likely teratogens in humans under certain circumstances were equally divergent. 3 of the 8 suspect teratogens were also not suspect in monkeys or didn't induce some developmental toxicity. 83 agents, 15 suspected human teratogens, 9 monkey species, and data too divergent to draw from." While scientists quite literally monkeyed around, Dr. Lenz's assumption, which was based on obvious and graphical epidemiological evidence in the form of hundreds of babies born with flippers or no limbs at all, was largely ignored for 5 more years. In that interval, until thalidomide was recalled in 1962, over 10,000 additional children were born crippled. By consistently providing a false negative results, animal studies claimed an active role in magnifying this tragedy. The pro-animal testing contingency still maintains that thalidomide was not tested on animals prior to its release. 2 scientists, Jack H. Botting and Adrian Morrison, so stated in a Scientific American article supporting animal testing. February 1997, they wrote, "Scientists never tested thalidomide in pregnant animals until after fetal deformities were observed in humans," quote unquote. To the complacent reader, this seems persuasive proof in favor of testing drugs in animals. But it's a gross misstatement. Since animal testing was already the established protocol, Botting and Morrison's claim is unlikely, even taken at face value. And according to a German medical journal of the epoch, toxicity tests on animals were conducted prior to thalidomide's release. And that appeared in... where did that appear? Chardin, no? Arzneimittelforschung, which means drug research, 1956, a German medical journal. And some of these tests were conducted on pregnant rodents, and phocomelia did not occur. It's controversial whether tests specific to teratogenicity were performed, though data from Germany suggests they were, as I've just mentioned. Even Time magazine, February 23, 1962, stated that thalidomide was released after 3 years of animal tests, quote-unquote. In any event, animal-modeled teratogenicity tests could never have been conclusive. In which animal would scientists have put their store? Mouse? Rabbit? Guinea pig? Primate? And in what dose? Further, administration of any drug to any species will at some juncture eventually induce nonspecific birth defects. Any drug. These tests could not have provided the kind of results required. As one scientist stated, there is at present no hard evidence to show the value of more extensive and more prolonged laboratory testing as a method of reducing eventual risk in human patients. In other words, the predictive value of studies carried out in animals is uncertain. The statutory bodies, such as the Committee on Safety of Medicines, which require these tests, does so largely as an act of faith, rather than on hard scientific grounds. With thalidomide, for example, it is only possible to produce specific deformities in a very small number of species of animals. In this particular case, therefore, it is unlikely that specific tests in pregnant animals would have given the necessary warning. The right species would probably never have been used. Even more striking, the practical adverse reactions have not been reproducible in any species except the human. Unquote. Only immense trial and error and enormous doses of thalidomide produced teratogenesis in isolated species. As was scientifically demonstrated, no amount of animal testing could have prevented the thalidomide disaster. And it is a notable irony that the very lack of side effects in animals tested with thalidomide allowed thalidomide to make it to market in the first place and then stay there in spite of the human studies. Yet again, the obvious. Why did they not use human tissue to predict human response? As is usual the case, research on human tissues in vitro could have averted the thalidomide disaster. This incident shows not the benefit of animal testing, but how animal testing sent treatments calamitously astray. It also illustrates the agility of those with a vested interest in animal experimentation, such as Botting and Morrison, for changing history to suit their agenda. You're listening to Dynamic Health on CFRO 102.7 FM. I'm sitting in for Croc Woodruff today. The thalidomide disaster heightened paranoia regarding the drug industry, and the paranoia was well-founded, but the solution in America strayed from reason. Senator Estes Kefauver, who had already distinguished himself by pushing legislation against organized crime, shouldered a new cause with Senator Hubert Humphrey, namely to overhaul the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act. The Food and Drug Administration was badly in need of revision. Naturally, Kefauver was much opposed in his efforts by lobbyists from the pharmaceutical industry, which was not eager to have its profitability checked in any way. His legislation, the Kefauver-Harris Act, which would not be passed until 1961, during the thalidomide furor, demanded that medications be not only safe, but also effective, a much overdue directive. Nevertheless, unnecessarily and disastrously, it would also mandate animal testing. Dramatic, but ill-informed, the Kefauver-Harris Act seemed to declare rodents, cats, dogs, primates, yes, but not our children. Plenty of scientists were aware of obstacles in the animal model in the early 60s. Studies had already demonstrated that animal testing of new medications in no way accurately reflected human complications or efficacy. The prestigious scientific journal The Lancet published, "We must face the fact that the most careful tests of a new drug's effects on animals may tell us little of its effects in humans." Well, this sentiment was echoed frequently in coming months. In one study of the time, scientists compared known side effects of 6 drugs in rats, dogs, and humans. The study restricted observations to visible side effects. Side effects such as headaches, which are difficult to identify in animals, were not included. Of the 78 adverse side effects seen in humans, only 36 or 46% of these were reported in the animals. Approximately the same results as one would expect from flipping a coin. So this was not news to pharmacologists, who were aware of the lack of parity since the birth of pharmacology. By mandating animal testing, Kefauver-Harris made it possible for drug companies to continue their slovenly development processes. As long as their compounds passed through plenty of lab animals, they could claim due diligence. Animal testing persisted and still persists because it provides a legal sanctuary for pharmaceutical companies. In fact, it is itself fundamentally malpractice. There's always less than a 50-50 chance that a medication tested on animals will provide the same results in humans, usually much less. This isn't science. It's expensive and dangerous gambling. And the achievements in administering to diabetics provide another boost to the animal testing protocol during the first half of the last century. Pro-animal experiment contingencies hailed the advent of animal insulin as a diabetic treatment as support for continued lab animal study. Certainly, animals have figured largely in the history of diabetic research and therapy. Again, however, there are profound holes in the assumption that animal experimentation was necessary. A discussion of this interlude provides another example of how a rush to commercialize compromised human lives and confounded the path to medical breakthrough. Diabetes is a very serious disease. Even today, It affects 10 to 14 million Americans. It's a leading cause of blindness, of amputation, kidney failure, and premature death. Much remains mysterious about diabetes, but what is understood is that it impairs delivery of the body's main fuel, glucose. Our digestive system breaks down food into glucose, a simple sugar. Normally, the hormone insulin, which is a protein composed of 51 amino acids, produced in the pancreas, ushers the glucose, or blood sugar as it's called, along through the bloodstream. Fat cells, muscle cells, and other cells have insulin receptors. When insulin attaches to a receptor, it triggers chemical reactions inside the cell that allow glucose to enter. In diabetics, blood cannot deliver glucose to cells because without insulin, cell membranes reject the glucose. When diabetes develops in childhood, it's because the pancreas, an organ of the digestive and endocrine systems, fail to produce sufficient insulin. Adult onset diabetes is different. There's an adequate supply of insulin, but the cells stop responding to it readily. There are numerous types of diabetes, but in all types, insulin receptors do not function properly, even in the presence of adequate glucose. Glucose accumulates in the bloodstream, raising blood sugar levels dangerously high. So let's consider when and how animal studies entered into the exploration of this tragic condition. In the first century before the Common Era, or of the Common Era, Aretaeus and Celsus described a disease of frequent urination, unquenchable thirst, and wasting. In the 17th century, Thomas Willis observed that the urine of people suffering from this disorder contained sugar. As early as 1788, Thomas Cawley and others performed autopsies on deceased diabetic patients and found consistent changes in the pancreas. Cawley also described other patients with pancreatic lesions that developed diabetes. Subsequent autopsies continuing into the 20th century repeatedly confirmed Cawley's findings. In 1833, another physician named Bright discovered pancreatic cancer in a diabetic patient, establishing another link between the disease and pancreatic dysfunction. In 1896, or 69 rather, scientists identified the islets of Langerhans, insulin-producing pancreatic cells that are affected in diabetic patients. In short, many pancreatic conditions, such as pancreatic cancer and pancreatitis inflammation and pancreatitis, which is inflammation of the pancreas, were already known to produce diabetic symptoms, reinforcing the disease's link with the pancreas before the 20th century with its predilection for animal experimentation. In 1870, a physician named A. Bouchardat renounced the practice of feeding extra sugar to patients in compensation for sugar loss in the urine. By contrast, he recommended diet changes and exercise. This then revolutionary idea continues to be a mainstay of diabetic theory today, or therapy today. In 1875, Bouchardat also noted the association of diabetes with lesions of the pancreas. In 1895, Hansemann reviewed the literature and found 72 cases of diabetes accompanied by lesions of the pancreas. However, based on dog experiments, he concluded that diabetes had nothing to do with the pancreas. Dr. Pierre-Marie found the association between acromegaly, a pituitary disorder, and sugar in the urine, thus connecting sugar metabolism and the pituitary gland in 1882. Another doctor, Atkinson, published data in 1938 that revealed 32% of all acromegalic patients suffered from diabetes. Bouchardat had published similar findings in 1908. For some reason, the scientist who validated this in dogs, Bernardo Houssay, ended up winning the Nobel Prize in 1947. Obviously, it is hardly fair to say dogs were responsible for his kudos, since sizable knowledge predated Houssay's experiments, and any number of human-based methods would have produced the same findings. It was not until animal experimentation entered the picture that the hitherto nicely progressing course of knowledge regarding the pancreas and diabetes ran amok. Considerable documentation around the turn of the century confirmed this. Claude Bernard conducted experiments on dogs that produced sugar in the urine. Remember, this had already been observed in humans. However, the condition in quadrupeds led Bernard to conjecture that diabetes was a liver disease, linking sugar transport to the liver and glycogen. He also conducted many experiments on animals' central nervous system in an attempt to establish a link there. Granted, the liver is involved in carbohydrate metabolism, and injuries to the brain can result in hyperglycemia, that is to say, elevated blood sugar levels. But this is not insulin resistance at the cellular level, or a lack of insulin production from the pancreas. These animal studies threw diabetes research off the track for many years. Because of animal studies, many scientists did not believe the pancreas to be involved in diabetes, nor that a hormone such as insulin existed. One scientist, Pfluger, stated that the pancreas does not play any part at all in the origin of diabetes, whether in fact there is such a thing as pancreatic diabetes. In the 1880s, intending to validate what had already been established in humans, scientists, most notably Joseph von Mehring and Oskar Minkowski, feverishly began removing pancreases from dogs and cats and pigs. Sure enough, the animals did become diabetic. In the early 1920s, two scientists, J.J.R. McLeod and Frederick Banting, were given credit for isolating insulin by extracting it from a dog. For this, they received a Nobel Prize. McLeod admitted that their contribution lay not in discovering insulin, for which they are often credited, but in providing evidence from the animal lab. McLeod and Banting were not obligated to extract insulin from a dog because certainly there was ample tissue from humans. They did so because it was a convention of the time. In that same year, Banting and another experimenter named Charles Best gave dog insulin to a human patient, a 14-year-old boy, with disastrous results. When accepting the Nobel Prize, Banting stated that the dog insulin had resulted in a marked reduction in the child's blood glucose level. In fact, it only went down an insignificant 25% and was accompanied by severe side effects. A second dose was not given due to the ineffectiveness and sequela of the first. J.B. Collip, a biochemist in McLeod's team, said that the administration of the dog insulin was absolutely useless. Note what scientists said about the dog experiments in 1922. The production of insulin originated in a wrongly conceived, wrongly conducted, and wrongly interpreted series of experiments. Quote, unquote. Even Banting and Best supporters said they were unqualified to do good work. Years later, scientists such as Pratt reviewed the entire insulin isolation experiments that occurred in Toronto and concluded that Banting and Best's dog experiments had not been vital. It was the chemistry of Collip and McLeod that had isolated and purified insulin. Michael Bliss, the historian, states, Banting and Best did not discover insulin. It is particularly important to repeat that Banting's great idea, duct ligation on dogs, played no essential part in the discovery, unquote. Banting and Best experimented on some dogs and by sheer happenstance persuaded people who had knowledge of in vitro research to look for insulin and purify it. Collip, McLeod, and other scientists modified the process of isolating and purifying insulin. Using in vitro techniques and later mass-produced insulin from pigs and cattle by reaping it in slaughterhouses. The real credit for purifying insulin should have gone to Collip, who used chemistry to purify the insulin. The existence of insulin was already well known. It was its purification that allowed harvest from slaughterhouses and administering to humans. Note what Bliss says about McLeod's opinion of the entire Banting and Best role in the purification of insulin. He said, in McLeod's mind, the whole importance of Banting and Best's experiments had been in convincing McLeod and the others of the team that the internal secretion, insulin, was there to get. In other words, providing evidence of the existence of insulin from the dog lab was the convincing factor. Another case of scientists not being convinced of something just because it was seen in humans. In the forthcoming years, scientists refined the substance. J.J. Abel, in 1926, purified pure insulin from animals. H.C. Hagedorn introduced protamine insulin, a longer-lasting form, in 1936. Some lab animal work with the new insulin suggested that it caused birth defects. Fortunately for diabetics, this is not the case in humans. Discussions of harvesting insulin from animals also introduces a very important distinction of relevance to the vivisection debate. The pro-vivisection community uses the concepts of animal experimentation and harvesting animal parts for use in humans interchangeably. But these activities are not the same, and they produce different risks. What's more, animal experimentation as it misleads science is the topic of our discussion here. And harvesting animal parts is not. We don't deny that some animal parts can be made to function in humans, but what the vivisection community often understates is the risk of those organs or chemicals. Animal tissue can be used for human benefit without misleading science. Heart valves from pigs, insulin from cows and pigs, the production of monoclonal antibodies from mice and so on. But these tissues and chemicals have risks, and as occurred with insulin, their ready availability delayed safer therapies. It's true that without insulin harvested from slaughterhouses, many diabetics would have lost their lives. It's also true that the harvest delayed the synthesis of far safer human insulin. Science and industry does not search for solutions to problems that are not apparent and hence do not appear profitable. Synthetically produced human insulin might have been developed much more quickly had science and industry not decided that animal insulin was just as good. What's more, animal insulin's availability shrouded the discovery of important diabetes contributing factors. And whereas animal insulin helped many diabetics, others suffered severe side effects, and it potentially endangered many more. Though it is true that beef and pork insulin saved lives, they also created an allergic reaction in some patients. Beef insulin has three amino acids that differ from humans, while pork insulin has only one. Although this sounds negligible, remember that it takes very little amino acids discrepancy to undermine health. Only one deviant amino acid is enough to produce a life-threatening disease such as cystic fibrosis or sickle cell anemia. Injecting animal-derived insulin also presented the considerable danger of contracting zoonosis, that is to say, viruses and bacteria and other microorganisms that cross from one species to another and may be dangerous in one that is not its host. Had researchers then recognized these potentialities as well as the gulf of differences between ruminants and humans, the exigency for human insulin would have resulted and it would have been developed much sooner. The ready availability of animal-derived insulin and the animal model in diabetes research has continued to encumber the investigation of diabetes throughout this century. Whereas ample resources were devoted to studying animal models, human diabetic observation limped along with little subsidy. The ability to treat patients suffering from diabetes without giving them insulin injections was discovered entirely by chance. In 1942, M. Jambon noticed that when patients were given sulfonamides, their blood sugar dropped precipitously. In 1954, patient observation again paid off. Dr. H. Frank was giving patients a new sulfonamide when he too observed symptoms of hypoglycemia. Dr. J. Fuchs then confirmed the observation by taking the medication himself. Today, the administration of oral antihyperglycemics, which arose from serendipity and from this self-experimentation, entirely dispenses with the need for insulin injections in many patients. Not until 1955 was the structure of human insulin revealed. By the 1970s, scientists had established the DNA sequence in the insulin gene, and in the next decade, spliced the gene into E. coli, thus creating a limitless supply of synthetically produced human insulin. A combination of in vitro research and technological breakthrough allowed the development of human insulin and insulin preparations that last longer in the body. Once geneticists located the genetic source of diabetes, genetic breeders scurried to cook up a special mouse for diabetic study. Not surprisingly, this non-obese diabetic, NOD, mouse has certain drawbacks. Unlike the human genome, the mouse genome contains two unlegged insulin genes. Drs. M. A. Atkinson and E. H. Leiter commented that, quote, our understanding of the pathogenic mechanism underlying type 1 diabetes development in non-obese diabetic mice is now quite advanced. However, this understanding has been accompanied by the realization that when this mouse is used as a surrogate for humans, genus-specific or genus-specific differences that restrict their interpretation are unavoidable. Unquote. In other words, the model doesn't work, and the differences are profound. Non-obese diabetic mice lack certain human immune system components. The NOD mice also resist diabetic ketoacidosis. And ketoacidosis is the most serious manifestation of diabetes. It's what leads to diabetic coma and frequently to death. So the fact that that rather important clinical sign is missing is considerable. Other models fare no better. Streptozotocin knocks out the islet of Langerhans cells in the pancreas in mice. B. Rodriguez and others, writing about STZ-induced diabetic lab animals in experimental models of diabetes, state, quote, "In conclusion, numerous types of experimental diabetes are available. But with the different animal models of diabetes, there will always be physiological, pathological, and morphological differences between models. Moreover, an unavoidable reality is that none of these animal models of diabetes are perfect equivalents to the human disease state," unquote. Scientists attempt to pass off the STZ-induced rat as a twin of the human diabetic patient. Yet problems very quickly arise. For example, the STZ rat does not require insulin to survive, as humans do, nor is it sensitive to renal toxicity, kidney toxicity brought about by exposure to the antibiotic gentamicin. But physicians discovered that humans are, particularly diabetics who have compromised renal function to begin with. Sharma and colleagues noted that, quote, "This model does not exactly reproduce the structural hallmark of diabetic nephropathy," that is to say, death of the kidneys or kidney disease. Not exactly, but remember, most of the people we quote have a vested interest in animal experimentation. Not exactly is really science speak for this does not predict anything for humans. The animal models actually differ dramatically. The STZ-injected rat does not require insulin to survive, and other diabetes models, the Zucker rat for one, do not even suffer from elevated blood glucose. Another writer states, "None of these models of insulin-dependent diabetes mellitus mimics all the characteristics encountered in the human form of the disease. Animals in which diabetes has been chemically induced may survive for several months in the absence of an exogenous supply of insulin, and in this respect, they differ markedly from the human disease." Unquote. Humans can't survive months without insulin. Certainly, this suggests some very substantial discrepancies. Likewise, referring to the experimental models, another authority writes, "No animal model of diabetes mellitus is a perfect model of the disease. Hence, a wide variety of models continue to be employed." Unquote. Non-human models misled the development of non-insulin therapies, such as oral antihyperglycemics for diabetes. The FDA recently approved troglitazone, and Park Davis marketed it as Regulin. This has been linked to severe hepatotoxicity, liver failure, and has been associated with as many as 155 deaths. This is not an isolated incidence. Repeatedly, the animal model has thwarted diabetes research due to the great differences in digestion and metabolic processes between species. The pancreas continues to be a difficult organ for animal experimenters today, but this has not slowed animal model attempts. In 1992, researchers had this to say about animal models of pancreatitis. Quote, "The most important role of experimental models in animals is their use in investigating aspects of pathogenesis, morphology, and diagnosis. Whether the induction of experimental acute pancreatitis by whatever means imitates the etiology or beginnings of it in humans seems to be most doubtful. As long as we do not know the true causative factors and their pathogenic principles in human acute pancreatitis, it remains speculative whether these models have a comparable pathogenesis. Finally, human acute pancreatitis seems to be a different disease than the one induced in experimental animals." Unquote. So due in part to dollars misallocated to animal labs, diabetes is still stunningly enigmatic. Most clinicians believe that strict glucose control through insulin injections offer advantages over a less regimented treatment plan, and we agree. However, insulin is a treatment, not a cure, for diabetes. The exact biochemical process through which insulin regulates blood sugar is still not known. Neither have researchers discovered how that lack of regulation results in diabetes. As one scientist has stated, quote, since the discovery of insulin in 1921, many physicians and patients alike have had the erroneous impression that the horrific disease, diabetes mellitus, has been conquered, unquote. Even in the 1920s, after insulin had been purified and was being given to diabetics, many heralded it as a cure. The insulin-centric nature of our investigation and treatment of diabetics may have produced a force for the trees kind of oversight. Importantly, even though as many as 20 to 30% of children are genetically predisposed to diabetes, most do not develop the disease. That is a pretty staggering discovery. It means other factors such as diet, exercise, and as yet unknown determinants bear significantly on susceptibility to this disease. The availability of insulin obfuscated more important and other factors. Clearly, diet and exercise can decrease or eliminate the amount of insulin needed for many patients and relieve them of the risk associated with taking insulin. Programs that reduce fat in the diet and increase exercise show dramatic benefits and enable some patients to get off antihyperglycemic medications in less than a month. By controlling glucose levels and maintaining low blood sugar, these diabetic patients also decrease the risk of complications. This is Dynamic Health on 102.7 FM in Vancouver. My name is John Pranger, and I'm sitting in for Croft Woodruff. And the insulin story is only one example of ways the animal model has insinuated itself into medical history. Added to the politics and distortion surrounding the thalidomide catastrophe, one can see how the ranks tightened for using lab animals. Their use was handy in so many ways, financially, first of all. The fact that animal testing became mandatory means that those who want it to persist can, with justification, say that animal studies have played a role in every discovery of the last decades. That is to say, yes, animals have figured in discoveries because lab animals are ubiquitous. They're everywhere. But the discoveries did not rely on them. It would take institutions, scientists, and bureaucrats who were entirely dedicated to circuiting the well-entrenched animal testing protocol to get a drug to market without having animal studies fit into the equation somewhere. Imagine how laborious this would be. How would one find scientists who had not done animal studies in school or afterwards? Where is a research institution without lab animals? Why would a pharmaceutical company, in a hurry to get a drug on the market, go to this trouble? Pharmaceutical companies have tried and true protocols for hastening along drug development. Ever since Kefauver-Harris, government agencies have required toxicity data on all chemicals and drugs prior to the release of a substance into circulation. This data tells them what quantity of a medication will kill. Of course, no one would suggest using humans for this. So, a test called the LD50 became the standard toxicity data-gathering method. And what is this LD50? It stands for lethal dose 50%. Incremental doses of a chemical are administered to animals, usually dogs and rats, until 50% of the subjects die. That dosage is then designated the LD50. The sheer volume of the substance can cause the death. Of all the tests described, the LD50 is arguably the most stupid because rats, dogs, and people do not and cannot react the same to medications. As is obvious even to the uninformed, a lot of variables such as the age, weight, and gender of the animal, the environmental conditions, and so on, torque the outcome, rendering it invalid even for the species tested. But never mind that, the government still wants the data. Agencies for many years required the LD50 before a drug company could release a new substance. Over the course of the last 5 decades, many drugs which were approved and labeled by virtue of tests like the LD50 had drastically different effects in humans. the breadth of difference between species became more and more visible. Take, for example, 45 drugs tested in 1978. Only 25% of those effects predicted by animals transpired in humans. As usual, animal tests didn't predict the actual side effects to humans. They also raised concerns that the side effects occurring in animals would not materialize in humans. What use was this animal model if it was not predictive? It's not easy for vested parties to admit that their sacred highbrow professions are really just grand-scale speculation with human health at stake and animals as currency. Nevertheless, Dr. Ralph Haywood, director of Huntington Research Center, stated, "The best guess for the correlation of adverse reaction in man and animal toxicity data is somewhere between 5 and 25%. Only 25, from 5 to 25%. Those odds make animal testing even more hit and miss than tossing a coin. Until 10 years ago, the LD50 test was still part of almost all regulatory guidelines for safety assessment of chemicals worldwide. At a 1987 congressional hearing on the subject, highly accredited toxicologists testified that the LD50 is not a biological constant and does not address toxicity to organs. So some government agencies are gradually seeing the light. The FDA no longer requires the LD50 and will accept in vitro tests for genotoxicity. Photogenotoxicity for drug protein binding and for drug metabolism, skin penetration and bioavailability, as well as skin irritation or photoreactivity. Even though the FDA does not require the LD50 because they accept it, the testing continues. It is a protocol research institution. It's a research protocol that institutions are familiar with, and they may not be tooled up to provide alternatives. The EPA still requires the LD50, the Environmental Protection Agency. So yes, animal testing for medications is itself an institution, unshakable despite its inexhaustible drawbacks. And even an FDA official confessed that most of the animal tests we accept have never been validated. They evolved over the last 20 years, and the FDA is comfortable with them. And so are the pharmaceutical companies. We mustn't overlook the ancillary benefits of animal testing that fall outside government requirements. Think how the litigious atmosphere has thickened since Kefauver-Harris. Malpractice litigation feeds what is now a bastion of animal experimentation. The United States has not yet addressed the issues of frivolous lawsuits and outrageous judgments with tort reform, so billions of dollars in animal testing and experimentation persist. Pharmaceutical companies, while privately acknowledging that animal testing doesn't work, continue to lobby for and use it because their attorneys can get up in front of juries and say, "See, my client did due diligence with bunnies and guinea pigs and rats, so don't levy damages against us. We've followed the law." On the other hand, knowledge that the animal testing convention is a false refuge for pharmaceutical companies is growing, and it may be that the legal profession will play a part in unraveling it as a shelter. Judges have on occasion ruled that studies on animals were untrustworthy and lacking in probative value, as one judge put it, and had dubious significance in the light of epidemiological data, and also that animal teratology studies are of scant utility in drawing conclusions about whether a substance will cause birth defects in humans. But ironically then, the legal system that legislated animal testing into being may eventually topple it. Well, we've got about 10 minutes left, so I'll just continue a little bit here. So most medications actually derive from one big contradiction. The government demands that we test all medications on animals prior to continuing to human trials, and it admits that applying animal data to humans is a leap of faith. No wonder, then, that each year tens of thousands of people get sick from legal pharmaceuticals, and many of them die. And no wonder our diseases go uncured. The government's requirement yields only two tangibles: a very accurate picture of the compound's effect on lab animals, whether positive or negative, and a legal harbor. I'm just going to take a little break. One moment, please. And we're back. It's Dynamic Health, 102.7 FM in Vancouver. We just had to answer the door there for the next show. So I'll just go over that a little bit again. The government's requirements yields only two tangibles: a very accurate picture of the compound's effect on lab animals, whether positive or negative, and a legal safe harbor for the government and drug companies. When drugs cause illness and death in humans, and there's an inquiry, all those involved in development and approval of the drug can point to copious animal testing and claim due diligence. The animal testing provides no surety whatsoever about what these chemicals do to humans, and even those in favor of the animal model are wary. In fact, the most widely respected textbook on the animal experimentation subject, the Handbook on Laboratory Animal Science, itself states, "Uncritical reliance on the results of animal tests can be dangerously misleading and has cost the health and lives of tens of thousands of humans, as in Sibagaiji's Clioquinol scandal, the Oprin disaster of Distra Products Limited, and or ICI's Araldin calamity, and thousands of drugs like that." Unquote. And human trials are still necessary. Those who say we test on animals to avoid testing on people are wrong. Once animal studies are complete, all new medications are evaluated on humans. The first people to take a new substance are being experimented on as surely as if they were guinea pigs locked in a laboratory. Open up a rat, a dog, a pig, and a human, you will find much the same terrain, but with differences. These visible differences have an impact when it comes to assimilating drugs. Consider the most commonly used species in toxicology research, the rat. Rats have no gallbladder. They excrete bile very effectively. Many drugs are excreted via bile, so this affects the half-life of the drug. Drugs bind to rat plasma much less efficiently. Rats always breathe through the nose. Because some chemicals are absorbed in the nose, some are filtered. So rats get a different mix of substances entering their systems. Also, they are nocturnal. Their gut flora are in a different location. Their skin has different absorptive properties than that of humans. Any one of these discrepancies will alter drug metabolism. And these are only differences on a gross level. Smaller differences, being largely chemical, are more difficult to observe. Therein lies a greater dilemma. Medications do not act on the macroorganism. The large, visible level of, say, keeping organs in the right arrangements or bones in the right place. Medications act on the microscopic level. They interrupt and or initiate chemical reactions, altering molecular activities that are far too small for the human eye to observe. Indeed, medications' actions are not apparent, even with high-tech instrumentation, until they occur. The discrepancies between diverse mammals are largely microscopic, imponderably intricate. They are born of millions of years of speciation, adaptation, and mutation. The more modern science reveals about genes, cell function, ion channels, proteins, and so on, the more apparent is the complex gulf between species, and the more ludicrous the existing requirement for animal testing becomes. I think we'll leave it there, and we'll end the show with a little bit of music. And we'll be back next week with Dynamic Health on 102.7 FM in Vancouver.